Hello, and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. Last week, we talked with Nicholas Bukola about his recent book, The Fire is Upon Us, James Baldwin, William F. Buckley, Jr., and the Debate Over Race in America. This week, we discussed the legacy of Norman Mailer with J. Michael Lennon, Mailer's archivist and authorized biographer, and Maureen Corrigan, book critic for NPR's Fresh Air. This conversation was originally recorded August 27th, 2018, and was recorded live at the American Writers Museum. We hope you enjoy entering the mind of a writer.
Tonight's program is a conversation about Norman Mailer, inspired by the release of Library of America's recent double anthology of his work, edited by Michael J. Lennon. Here to talk about Mailer's enduring legacy are Mike Lennon, Maureen Corrigan, and Tony Smith. Lennon is Emeritus Professor of English at Wilkes University. He's Norman Mailer's archivist, editor, and authorized biographer, and president of the Norman Mailer Society. And I just found out that he also has Norman Mailer's teeth. His books include Norman Mailer, A Double Life, and Selected Letters of Norman Mailer. Maureen Corrigan, book critic for NPR's Fresh Air, is the Nikki and Jamie Grant Distinguished Professor of the Practice in Literary Criticism at Georgetown University. She is an associate editor of and contributor to Mystery and Suspense Writers and the winner of the 1999 Edgar Award for Criticism presented by the Mystery Writers of America. Corrigan served as a juror for the 2012 Pulitzer Prize in Fiction and was one of the voices instrumental in helping to build this museum. And if you didn't notice, you can go watch her in the middle circle of those screens in the other room. And tonight's conversation is moderated by reporter Tony Smith, a broadcast journalist, meteorologist, and board member of the National Association of Black Journalists, Chicago chapter. Thank you all for coming, and I'm going to hand it over.
Well, thank you, everyone, for coming out tonight. I met these two earlier, and I feel like we're going to be wowed on tonight. So, but let's get right to it. Here we are at 6:32. For the most part, can you guys explain the editing process of this book? You know, like, it's a lot. You know, I had a week to read it, and I was just wowed, and I was just sitting there turning the pages, and I was like, my mouth started to drop because as a millennial, like, we don't read the books anymore. We walk around with these. But actually had to sit there and just dive in, and I dived in, and explain this editing process.
Library of America tries to publish an utterly reliable edition of the great works of American writers. And these were, I think, number 307 and 308 of the books they've been publishing since around 1970. They do about 20 titles a year. And so they go to people who know a lot about an author, and they say, would you help us select which books we should publish? With Mailer, it was particularly difficult because he would write a novel, then he would write nonfiction, then he'd write a biography, then he'd do a sports book, then he'd do journalism, political journalism. And so it wasn't, with John Updike, you know, you could say, all right, here are his novels from this period, and then his novels from this period, and work your way through them. And the same with Philip Roth. With Mailer, it was a lot trickier. And we discussed for a long time the way to do it. And I was kind of interested in the generic way. Let's do the biographies of Mailer. Let's do the nonfiction. Let's do the fiction. And we kicked it around for a long time. And they finally made a very compelling argument, which was, it's time to do the 60s. This is the time to do the 60s. The events of the 60s reverberate through the decade that we're in now. And it might have been Mailer's best decade. And so what we have here is a potpourri of two volumes. One has two novels and two nonfiction books. And the ones we're going to talk about tonight are Miami and the Siege of Chicago, about the events of 50 years ago this week in this great city. And the other one was The Armies of the Night, which was about the March in the Pentagon in 1967 that Mailer was involved with. And then there were two novels he wrote in that period. The other volume has all of Mailer's essays, most of them published in other books, in three or four other books, and the process then was to pick the best essays that he wrote during the 60s. And he wrote an awful lot of them, a lot of journalism. We ended up with 32 or 33 essays. And so selecting them was really the hardest job, and then trying to determine which do you use. Do you use the original one that appeared in a magazine? Do you use the one that was reprinted in a book by him in which he made changes? Do you use the one that later on in another book by him where he put together all of his stuff in one gigantic 1,200-page book, that one, or he made still further changes? And there are always people who are writing titles for the works of authors when they write for magazines, and so they weren't really his titles. So whose title do you use? So we had to wrestle with all those questions and try to get the right one. And then we had to, you know, just do the kind of grunt work of identifying every person in the nonfiction books. Who were they? And a lot of them are old governors who were at political conventions in 1964 that, you know, would not be easily remembered. And so that was kind of the slogging through the internet to find all that information and learning a lot as I went along. That was the process.
Wow. And speaking of that process, Maureen, how did they do?
Well, I was interested, Tony, when you said you sat down for a week and read this. And I was trying to think about what that experience is like, what it was like for me to go back and reread Miami and the Siege of Chicago and just be bathed in this language. I mean, it is so alive. It's so crazy. It's like, what is this language do for you that, say, watching the clips that probably a lot of us have been watching from 50 years ago, the last few days, to be with Mailer as he's sifting through this kaleidoscope of events around him, it's just so fabulous to be in his company. And I can't imagine editing Mailer. I mean, I'm so glad I didn't have your job. But I'm so happy I have the job of being a reader and appreciating just the gusto. I think I asked you this in an email, Mike, and you didn't really realize that it was a question. But when I read Mailer, I keep thinking, this guy loved to write. You know, it just seems like he could have written 12 sentences for every sentence that landed on the page, and they would have all been great. Did he enjoy writing?
He liked it when he got into the process. He had to crank himself up. But once he got a routine going, he would work, and he would work very, very hard, double shifts in many cases until 9 o'clock at night. Many people think Mailer just spent a lot of his time in bar rooms and getting in trouble on television shows and things like that. And he did, but he was really a very hard worker. Miami and the Siege of Chicago was written in 2 weeks, 75,000 words. And the Armies of the Night took about 6 weeks. And so you can make a case, and in fact, you made it, Maureen, earlier, that some of his best writing is not the books he labored on for 10 years, but the books that he wrote under deadline pressure. He was a terrific deadline writer, and he loved that the challenge. And they'd say, okay, Life magazine needs 25,000 words on Muhammad Ali and Joe Frazier, and, you know, we go to press every week, we got to have it. And he would turn them in. He wrote 18,000 words in 72 hours for Life magazine for one of the Muhammad Ali's fights. So he did like it to that extent that he could really throw himself in it. And he was almost like a decathlon event of a kind where you go, how much can you write in one particular day? And then also had to do the research. And then he had to read the drafts. He would wear his secretaries out. He'd have two secretaries typing, and they'd be, when he got finished writing for the day, they'd feed him the drafts, and he would go over the drafts and make the corrections. So there's a stream of drafts coming back to him all the time. And probably when he turned in those books, they'd gone through four drafts in 2 weeks as well.
Wow. I just can't believe, you know, he's my kind of man. You know, being in TV, dealing with those deadlines, I got to tell you. But, yeah, wish I would have known him. But I feel like I'm getting to know him. Now, speaking of, you know, this book and the parallels, do we see any of that today? Like, in this writing, like, I was envisioning a few things, but what about you two?
Well, you know, a phrase sticks in my mind. One historian has talked about our current age as the age of fragmentation. And I feel like when I'm rereading these essays, I'm seeing where it started. You know, 1967, Armies of the Night, 68, these events. This is when America is really starting to come apart at the seams. And you see Mailer in these two books, two long essays, really trying to, I don't know, almost witness it. I don't know if he doesn't really come to conclusions, which is part of the strength of his writing, but witnessing, you know, you've got the new left, you've got the old Republicans, you've got the old Democrats, you know, you've got the intellectuals, you've got the trade unionists.
The hippies and the yippies and the Black Panthers.
Yeah, all of them. And, you know, I always loved that Mailer. Oh, his discomfort with Eugene McCarthy. What does he call his followers? Disinfected idealists. I mean, these phrases, they just jump out. But certainly, as he's looking at this scene in front of him of just the fragmented society, well, we can just draw the line to the present. I think he's looking in almost a visionary way, although maybe he doesn't realize it. He's looking forward to what we're wrestling with today.
You think of in 68, you know, Andy Warhol was shot one day, Robert Kennedy shot the next day. A month before that, LBJ said he wasn't going to run for president again. You had riots in the street after Martin Luther King was killed. I mean, the string of events, Malcolm X and Martin Luther King and two Kennedys, and I mean, Andy Warhol was the shooting of Andy Hall was lost because Bobby Kennedy's death happened the next day. I mean, I'm sure I know there's a lot of people in this room that remember those weeks, and they were utterly stunning. And Mailer, you know, felt that it was his obligation to be a witness and essentially testify on what was happening. And he had models from people in the past. From some of the great writers in the past that witnessed things, Mencken, H.L. Mencken, and Dreiser, and people like that who had witnessed the great events, and Henry Adams. And they were very much on his mind when he was writing his books. He knew who, somebody said, you know, I think it was the guy that ran the Washington Post, Philip Graham, that journalism is the first draft of history. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Mailer's book may be the last draft. We will rely on Armies of the Night to tell us what happened in Chicago 50 years ago more than any other document, I think.
You know, I just want to add to that timeline. Since I live with a historian, my husband reminded me that, what was it, a month before LBJ resigned, Cronkite comes on national news and says about Vietnam, we're in a mess, you know. And there's, you know, the great white father saying, throwing up his hands and saying to America, we don't know what we're doing. What a moment that must have been. I mean, I was 13 at the time, so I don't have those same kind of whatever young adult memories that you have. But I just think that must have been earth-shattering, given the prominence that somebody like Cronkite had at the time.
Well, the people in the audience here, I mean, you all remember Vietnam, a lot of you. I can tell by looking out there at the white hair. You remember Vietnam, you know. I mean, it went on and on and on and on. It just didn't seem it was ever, ever going to stop. You know, somebody said when Mailer went to Washington for the Armies of the Night, Abby Hoffman and Jerry Rubin said, we're going to levitate the Pentagon. We're going to make it rise in the air and turn around six times and disappear. And someone said, well, why not? Nothing else seems to work to get rid of the war in Vietnam. Why not try that? It can't hurt. And, of course, they did try to levitate it. You know, it's a very, very funny scene in Armies of the Night when they out demons out and they chant and they, you know, blow incense and Allen Ginsberg is there with his cymbals. And we don't have as much of that zaniness. There was that the zany period when you had, you know, people like Abby Hoffman and Jerry Rubin and the Fugs around doing all that crazy stuff. Now, it seems, maybe I'm wrong. I mean, things don't seem as funny anymore. It seems more grim.
Speaking of now and versus then, how do you think young activism today kind of translates to now to then?
The politics in this book, really, the Democratic politics, was up from the bottom. I mean, the old Democratic Party was dying, and it was the young people who were doing it. They were the hippies and the yippies and a lot of, the SDS and the anti-war movement, the Black Power movement, all those movements were going on. Unfortunately, when the violence happened, after the violence happened in Chicago and the polls went out, even though it had been called a police riot in the Walker Report, a majority of Americans were on the side of the police. And so looking back, many people feel middle class Americans were alienated by too much violence, too much craziness, and Mailer was in the book. He's ambivalent about these young protesters because they're saying, well, let's put LSD in the water. He's going, wait a minute. Now this is not a great idea. They nominated a pig for president. Well, at a certain point, serious people with serious political interests thought this was crazy. Now we've got we've got the Occupy movement, we've got Resist movement, we've got the kids who are the guns in school protesting against that. But there's no common front. It was pretty splintered then, but there is no common front, less of a common front. I mean, when they marched at the Pentagon, I mean, somehow they got, 100,000 people under one banner, and it was all against the war in Vietnam, pulled them all together, even though they had, all their different interests beside that. I don't see, maybe there's one thing that a lot of people are against.
Well, to go back to that age of fragmentation idea, it's also the age of identity politics. So everybody is sort of gathered in their own camp. I mean, you see some of that here, some of that beginning. But as you say, the uniting under a common umbrella of aims and aspirations, that seems more difficult today. That also, the fact that we are in this age of fragmentation, I think also explains why Mailer isn't as popular today, or isn't read as much today. He really, as you know better than anyone in this room, Mike, I mean, he's branded, he's a hard sell to classes. I teach him in some of my classes at Georgetown, but he really, I really have to do a lot of prep work to say, well, yes, he did stab one of his wives and, blah, blah, blah. You really have to make the case for Mailer in a way that at the time he was writing this, he didn't have to make the case for himself.
No, his books people would just line up at the stores to buy his books in those days because they knew there was someone with intelligence who could write seriously about all the people and knew them. I mean, Mailer knew a lot of he knew Gene McCarthy very well. He was very friendly with McCarthy. He admired McCarthy and didn't admire everything about him, as you point out. He didn't admire the fact that McCarthy didn't look like he was trying anymore. It looked like he was in love with defeat. And I think that was, a part of it. Whereas Hubert Humphrey was just the opposite. And Humphrey got the nomination, and we all know what followed after that.
So do you think we learned anything from now to then?
Well, for a long time after after Vietnam, there was this feeling, we don't ever want to go to war again. We don't ever want to go to war again. And there was a lot of talk about the peace dividend, all the money we were spending on the armed forces and nuclear weapons. And for a long period of time, we were closing down the nuclear weapons and we eliminated the draft. Probably one of the most, if we had a draft on now, we would not have wars going on in Afghanistan. We would not have the war going on in Iraq, which are going on longer than the war in Vietnam. We would not have that if the draft was on now. I went in the service, and my brother who's here, we went in the service because, if you didn't join, you were going to get drafted. You could go to Canada if you wanted to. But a lot of people went in, and these days that option is not there anymore. I didn't like the idea of the draft, but now I look back on it with a little bit of nostalgia. I mean, it was a really leveling thing to go in the service and meet people from the South, the North, every race, color, gender, part of the country. It was really an education for millions of men.
Well, Mike and I have been talking a little bit about an essay we both admire that's coming out in The New Yorker this week, but that you turned me on to, by David Denby, and he, about Miami and the Siege of Chicago. And he ends his essay by saying, well, that's certainly, he says it was the worst time in American history, recent American history, and that we're living in the second to worst time now, so that we can maybe take heart from reading this, that we'll come through.
Let me read the last. This is the end of the essay by David Denby in The New Yorker. And he's talking about Mailer had arguments with the Black Power movement, with the Black Panthers. And he says what Mailer had to say would be of zero significance were it not for what follows on the next page of Miami and the Siege of Chicago. Blacks, Mailer writes, were trying to make whites guilty. But how guilty? This is Mailer speaking. Since obsessions dragoon our energy by endless repetitive contemplations of guilt, we can neither measure nor forget, political power of the most frightening sort was obviously waiting for the first demagogue who would smash the obsession and free the white man of his guilt. Torrents of energy would be loosed. Yes, those same torrents which Hitler had freed in the Germans when he exploded their 10-year obsession with whether they had lost the First World War through betrayal or through material weakness. Through betrayal, Hitler had told them. That's the end of him. And then this is the last paragraph. The premonition of Donald Trump and what Trump has loosed in his audience was written exactly 50 years ago. At the moment, not one word of it seems excessive. Miami and the Siege of Chicago was composed at the worst time in our national life, though the current moment is a close second. Reading it gives not only pleasure of a literary sort, but strength and solace. If the country could survive 1968, it will survive Donald Trump, too.
Oof. And that's coming from me. Like, wow. So how did you first encounter Mailer? Like, you got to reminisce and like, oh, you just stumbled on it?
Yeah. I think I did just stumble over it. I was the editor of my high school newspaper. And it was the age of new journalism, you know, so, let's see. I graduated high school in '73. I mean, it was picking up. Certainly, it was out there. So I was reading people like Ken Kesey and, you know, Mailer, Tom Wolfe. I loved the idea that as a journalist, which I at that point I thought I wanted to be, that you could put yourself into the story, and that the story could be more than just, you know, sticking to just the facts, ma'am, just the facts. So I really loved their writing. I loved the energy of it. I think I read Armies of the Night and Miami and the Siege of Chicago pretty early. I love, and the earlier pieces that Mailer wrote about the 1960, Democratic Convention. I really loved those pieces. And I was a nice Catholic schoolgirl. I loved the fact that he seemed like he would say anything and he could get away with it because he was funny and sassy. And that's an American voice. That voice that's funny and irreverent and, God.
Obscene as well.
Yeah, and obscene, yeah.
He loved the notion of obscenity as part of humor, and he felt that if it was done correctly, he hated that, you know, just wholesale swear words. He thought that was ridiculous, but if it was used adroitly and deftly, obscenity could be extremely funny. And this was a time when you could not use any four-letter words, and so there was always, Mailer was always having big battles with the New Yorker. When was he going to be able to say F-U-C-K in the New Yorker? And he kept trying, and they kept saying no. Well, now, of course, that's going by the board now. There's not much that you can't say anymore. But yeah, his humor and his sassiness and his obscenity and his daring really engaged me when I was a young man.
Oh, I was just going to say, you can't say it on NPR. We're still very polite.
Well, speaking of this, his essays, any one particular sticks out to you the most? Like, if you had that one, you just had to read it again.
Well, I think I think Superman Comes to the Supermarket, that Mailer wrote about Jack Kennedy when he in 1960, and it came out just before the 60 election, has always been one of my favorites, because Mailer immediately saw that one of the reasons Jack Kennedy was so attractive is that he looked like a movie star. And he had a tan on him and those flashing white teeth. And Mailer saw him at the convention in Los Angeles, being carried in on the shoulders of all these people, and like he was a bullfighter. It just had a big victory in the bull ring. And he realized there was something different going on here. And of course, he had a beautiful, talented wife as well. And so, you know, this was after 8 years of Eisenhower, Mamie and Ike, who, you know, pretty staid characters. And Jack Kennedy was not. And he had that remote air about him, Kennedy. Mailer said he looked like a young English professor who was kind of detached and looked like he was trying to figure out some problem in his PhD thesis, and he wasn't sure about it. And he had that kind of, you know, he wasn't in your face. Kennedy always had that little slight remoteness about him, as well as his good looks and his sense of humor, too. Kennedy had a great wit as well. Great wit. And so they were a team that was made in heaven, Jack Kennedy and Mailer. And on the strength of that, Mailer decided he was going to run for mayor of New York. He said, why not? And he tried to get his family to do it. He said, well, all the Kennedy family help him. Why won't you help me? And they all thought he was crazy. And he was at the time. He was going to run on the existentialist ticket. And, of course, there was no existentialist party in New York. Never was, and so on. And so they realized then. And then he cracked up after that. But it was Kennedy who mobilized him. Mailer had never voted in an election since he voted for FDR in the 1940s, in 1944. He had not voted in any election. He was completely alienated. He was a beatnik. You know, he was living in Greenwich Village. But Kennedy brought him back into American political life.
Can't follow that. But, you know, Mike, you quoted a little bit of his description of JFK, and I think that's another thing about Mailer's writing that I don't know if we're going to get to it, so I'll just jump in. But the word Dickensian is applied to these character portraits that he's giving us in just one sentence, two sentences. Mike and I had to have a preparatory glass of wine before coming over here tonight, you know, kind of in the imagined Mailer style. And we were just throwing these lines at each other, you know, David Eisenhower looking like he would play Billy Budd in a high school production. my mouth drops open in awe. There's nothing stale or canned. The sentences never end in a place that I expect them to. It's just so fresh. And
give him the Hubert Humphrey?
Yes.
This is a description of Hubert Humphrey when Humphrey has accepted the Democratic nomination in 68. And Mailer was not a big fan of Humphrey, but he said, Humphrey had a face which was as dependent upon cosmetics as the protagonist of a coffin. The results were about as dynamic. Makeup on Hubert's face somehow suggested that the flesh beneath was the color of putty. It gave him a shaky, put-together look of a sales manager in a small corporation who takes a drink to get up in the morning, and another drink after he has made his intercom calls, the sort of man who is not proud of drinking, and so in the coffee break he goes into the John and throws a sen-sen down his throat. All day he exudes odors all over, sen-sen, lime water, pomade, bay rum, deodorant, talcum, garlic, a whiff of the medicinal, the odor of scotch on a nervous tummy, rubbing alcohol. And it's so true of Humphrey. He has another line in here where he says that Humphrey's syntax was so slovenly that it resembled a freight train manager in a freight yard trying to find a freight car and has to move every single freight car in the train yard in order to find the one car that he needs. And that's the way he would shunt phrases around and never really, you know, his sentences didn't really come to any conclusion.
And we have to get Nixon in. Yeah. My favorite was Nixon standing with his hands cupped in front of him, looking like an old con appearing before the parole board. Yeah.
He said that the old Nixon reminded him of a church usher who would catch a boy talking in church and would pull him out of the pew by his ear. And once he got him outside, he'd give the ear a twist.
But those descriptions, the other thing about them is they're not just to show off. You know, especially for me, rereading the essays, to read the Miami essay and to think about the Republican Party and what's looming, that Mailer, you know, Mailer ends with Reagan. He's, you know, and Reagan at that point is not the star, right? It's Rockefeller, Nixon gets the nomination. But he ends with Reagan, you know, almost sort of, even if he's not conscious of it, sensing that there's something there that might take hold.
And McGovern.
Yeah,
he ends with Reagan and McGovern. He almost he can feel it that's coming up. Yeah, he sees that McGovern comes in at the last minute and tries to steal votes from Gene McCarthy, and he does steal some as well because he's at least willing to talk. McCarthy wouldn't say anything. He said, "You know my position. That's it. That'll be it." You know? And back up to the monastery in Minnesota. You know, where we get up at 5 o'clock in the morning with the monks and say his prayers. So.
Wow, so funny. Wanted to know, what would you say Mailer's message would be for us today? If he was here, you know, talking about this book, you know, what would you think his message would be?
Well, I think he would talk about the fragility of democracy. He always said, he talked about it all the time. He was always worried about it. He said, you know, I grew up and my mother talked about Hitler. And what Hitler was doing to the Jews in Europe. And she said, you know, it can happen anywhere, it can happen anywhere. And, oh, Mom, you know, that was a long time ago. But he realized that democracy wasn't a given, that it was something that had to be tested and fought for. Blood had to be shed occasionally. I mean, who said that? Thomas Jefferson, you know, the tree of liberty is nourished with the blood of patriots and so forth. Well, but it required work. That could slip away, that people could, he always talked about a soft fascism coming to the United States that wouldn't look like there wouldn't be jackboots in the street as in Europe, but there would be little by little an erosion of the powers of the press, of the powers of the courts and so forth and so on. And if he were here, that's exactly what he would say. You agree, Maureen?
You're the expert, but yeah, I can't imagine Mailer here. You know, I almost can't imagine him in this time with the shrinking of outlets for writing such as this, you know, and even maybe the shrinking of an audience for writing such as this. It's hard for me to imagine him here.
Don't you think that isn't there kind of a minor comeback of long form narrative now where people are writing? Journalists don't want just to do sound bites, that they're interested in doing the longer pieces. Have you found that?
Yeah. My station, Into Investigative Reporting, you know, they have a whole, you know, we're on your side. And, like, literally, that is kind of the bread and butter. And people actually watch four-minute packages. And I'm, like, sitting there, like, when is this going to be over? I go to the bathroom. I come back. It's like, you know, but, yeah, it's going that way.
I wonder what Mailer would have thought about what he and those other new journalists unleashed on the world, you know, because I think sometimes people think forms like this that are sort of a mixture of novelistic techniques with journalism, that they've sort of opened the door to, you know, what we live with now, truth isn't truth, or there's so many kinds of truth, and it's all just your impression, and your impression differs from my impression, and they're equally valid. I think I see it with my students, that they don't they don't seem to respect the line between novelistic techniques and fact, and that it's all narrative. And I think that that's maybe an unfortunate legacy of new journalism. It's all narrative, so what does it matter?
Well, but think of the gains, too. You know, it used to be reporters used to write, New York Times reporters, as I think Tom Wolfe said this. He said you would read their pieces, and it was like listening to the announcer of a tennis match who had to speak in tones like this very carefully because they were out there serving the ball. And so you never had the voice of the writer was lost. There was no room to show off a little bit, to serve up a lot of metaphor. I mean, if you're interested in metaphor, there's more metaphor in this book. Mailer can't go more than a sentence or two without coming up with a metaphor. And a lot of times he misses, but most of the time he has a real gift for creating metaphor, and that illumines all of his subjects. Well, you know, metaphor didn't go with old-time journalism. I mean, you could use a metaphor now and then, maybe in the opening of your piece, but you couldn't ream your piece with a lot of different kinds of metaphor or dialogue or dramatic scenes. And I think those have been additions to journalism that have improved journalism. But you're right, some bad stuff might come in this wake.
Yeah. Now, speaking of his voice, if he was here, or... Speaking of it, Maureen, I want you to answer this if you can. What would he say today? Because, you know, you guys said you were trying to channel him earlier. They had some wine.
I wish he were here today. I would love to read what he would write about today's politics and today's world. I mean, I can't imagine, but... I would love to see, gosh, that's an unwritten piece, you know, that's almost worthy of some novelist attempting, you know, Norman Mailer's take on Donald Trump. I mean, that's who we're talking about.
A lot of people I've been asked that question 20 times, and I've read innumerable pieces in which saying, I wonder what Mailer would say. I wonder what he would have to say. Well, you know, he knew Donald Trump because they both lived in New York. And he used to take, Trump had these black helicopters down on the west side in New York City on the river. And he would, these black helicopters, and they would shuttle people down to the Trump casinos. And they had boxing matches there. And Mailer used to get a free ride down and go to the boxing matches. So I know he knew Trump. I've seen pictures of him. And I know Trump gave 1,000 hotel rooms to the Penn Conference, the International Writers Conference in 1986. Gay Talese talked him into it. And Trump gave him, and so on. So I know, and Trump was always there. And if you lived in New York City, you read the New York papers, Trump was in the gossip columns constantly, all through the 80s and 90s. He was being quoted, or somebody was quoting him. He had a lot of preparation for his tweeting.
Now, we spoke about the metaphors. We spoke about his voice. What would you kind of say is your aha moment for everybody, or like, you know, one most interesting or unique thing about this collection?
Well, Mike read part of it in quoting from Denby. I mean, everybody who talks about Miami and the siege of Chicago talks about that moment where Mailer is waiting for Ralph Abernathy, and he's tired of waiting, and he's saying to himself, and again, this was partly in the section that you read, Mike. Mm-hmm. He's saying, "I'm tired of blacks and their demands. You know, I'm tired of their complaints. You know, and if I'm tired, how do people who aren't as, I mean, I don't think he'd like to call himself a liberal, but or aren't as somehow broad-minded, whatever, supportive as me." How are those white folks feeling? And, you know, what's going to happen? What's going to set them off? I mean, that's a moment that stops you cold if you haven't read this book in a while,
well,
or if you've never read it.
They're waiting for Ralph Abernathy.
Yeah.
And he said he was tired of blacks coming late to meetings just because they you know, They had been slaves, and now that they were free, they were going to show everybody, and they're going to come late. And he goes, all right, fine, but I'm getting tired of sitting here. And Abernathy came in 45 minutes late, and there was 100 reporters in the room. They were all waiting and so forth. And so that led to, he said, he got this thought in his head. He didn't know where it come from. He'd never thought it before. He goes, I'm getting tired of this. And that leads him to a whole riff on, well, I bet there's a lot of white people out there that are angry. And then, of course, George Wallace gets 10 million votes in the election, which in many ways he was a stalking horse for a lot of things that happened.
But that section also makes me stop and think, too, who would write that today? What white writer
would admit it
right. Who wasn't completely, you know...
Yeah. It wasn't a white
extreme,
supremacist, right?
extreme right wing. Who would admit that stuff? I mean, it was pretty. I imagine it was pretty.
Review quoted about it. Every review brought it up, and at the same time, he was saying maybe Nixon has changed.
Yeah.
Maybe it doesn't seem like the old Nixon anymore. It looks like he's learned a lot. He's had his punishment. He get defeated. Running for president, then he get defeated. Remember, he lost the running for governor of California in 62. He lost that. He's learned his lesson. Maybe the new Nixon is going to be better. People, Mailer was always interrogating the standard positions. What is the standard position on what liberals, what their relationship should be with the Black Power movement? Supportive. We're all for it, right? He interrogates that. What do people feel about Richard Nixon? He was saying, well, look, I'm going to, look at his daughters. They're so beautiful. A man who could produce daughters like that, he can't be all bad. So he was looking for ways so he was always complicating the interrogation and not just going with the party line. I think that's part of his technique in everything he writes.
Yeah. I'm glad you mentioned Nixon's daughters, because they and the Nixonettes and the Nixonaires, the cheerleaders, I think it's almost like reading Moby Dick, and you see Ahab's wife, and that's the last time a woman appears in all of Moby Dick. It really is startling again to read this book and to look at that landscape and realize, boy, we needed that second wave women's movement immediately, ASAP. You know, well, it was going on, but
this had kind of pushed everything off the map until it really got going in 1971. That's going to be the next book, the 70s. Mailer's books in the 70s.
Well, let's thank Maureen and Mike.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the AWM Author Talks podcast. Next week, we'll chat with Colin Asher about his recent biography, Never a Lovely So Real, The Life and Work of Nelson Algren. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.